Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, possible changes to a project long in the making as Mecklenburg County commissioners consider replacing market-rate apartments with affordable housing units at Brooklyn Village. Changes are also coming to Charlotte's clean energy benchmarks. They will likely delay the city's objectives. We look at the impact of the Trump administration's deportation efforts locally. Governor Josh Stein asks for another $1 billion for Hurricane Helene relief and a change in venue for the never-ending case of who won the election for a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
So the blizzard of changes coming out of Washington from the Trump administration isn't just affecting people in D.C. It's having an impact nationwide and here in Charlotte. And one of the early impacts has been efforts targeted at immigrants who are here illegally. WFAE's Julian Berger has been focusing on that in a series of reports over the last several weeks on our air. And I want to add him to the panel for this first part of the conversation as we look at what's happening as the promised crackdown begins. Overall, Julian, how would you describe the concern level within the Charlotte immigrant community?
There's a lot of fear. We've been seeing numerous reports on social media of potential ICE activity within the area. So the community that I've been speaking to, there's just been a lot of fear. They're not sure what's going on. On social media, there's been a lot of videos spreading around of, is this an ICE vehicle? Is this, you know, are these ICE agents? Immigrants really don't know who to trust at this time and kind of whether or not they are in danger.
And you called them potential or possible. I forgot the exact word that you just used, ICE incursions into the community. Have there been any concrete actions that have taken place?
Yeah, so we saw a few sightings, confirmed sightings last week, and specifically in South Charlotte on Archdale Drive. I've been speaking with Carolina Migrant Network, who is the nonprofit organization in the Charlotte area that has been confirming those sightings. So they'll get reports into a phone number that they have, and then they'll send volunteers to go and confirm and make sure that they're ICE agents.
And Joe Bruno's with us from WSOC-TV yesterday. Joe, you embedded with some ICE agents for activities going on where? In the Harrisburg area, is that correct?
Yeah, North Charlotte, Harrisburg area. I can confirm that ICE is conducting daily arrests targeting known, what they describe as known criminals with histories that they are familiar with. And it is not a raid. They are not raiding places. They are not going into hospitals or schools or anything. They are focusing on street enforcement right now.
Your story will air on Channel 9 later today, but what did you experience as an embed?
I got up at around 4 or 5 a.m. yesterday and met up with ICE at their office, and we went out into a neighborhood in North Charlotte where they have been keeping an eye on a man for at least a week. So they knew his schedule. They knew his tendencies. And when he left his house that day, the three unmarked vehicles made a traffic stop. He instantly knew he was being followed by ICE. ICE believes because they think that people are also surveilling them. And there's a network going on both sides. They're surveilling the suspect. People are surveilling ICE. So he knew instantly, even though it was an unmarked car, that he was about to be pulled over by ICE. He ditched his car in a park, and then there was a foot chase, and he was eventually taken into custody, and now he's been transferred to Alamance County Detention Center.
So to every action, there is a reaction, and that's happening here, Julian. Some immigrant-owned businesses in Charlotte were closed on Monday as part of a nationwide protest called Day Without Immigrants. This is not the first time this has happened. It was a day intended to demonstrate the role that immigrants play in the economy, not only from people patronizing local immigrant-owned businesses, but also the economic impact of immigrants who buy things in other locations. They were called on to stay home, not buy anything this past Monday. How many local businesses, how many local immigrants participated in that, and can we assess the impact?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the number of immigrants that did participate, but we did see a large number of immigrant-owned businesses shut down on Monday. So Tacos El Nevado, a very popular Mexican restaurant in East Charlotte, as well as South Boulevard, they shut down. Don Pedro Mexican restaurants, they have a few locations throughout the city, they shut down. El Arma de la Luna dance company, they shut down. Rodrigo and Wendy is another dance company here in Charlotte, they shut down. So it was primarily restaurants as well as immigrant-owned businesses that did shut down on Monday. And then they opened up Tuesday.
This also affected the schools. Julian Parmenter, who's been on this program, is a seventh grade English teacher at the South Academy of International Languages. He told The Observer that he saw triple the absences he would normally expect on a Monday. And on Monday, the CMS board released a statement amid growing concerns over potential immigration enforcement action, saying that no immigration enforcement has taken place on any CMS campus to date. And they added, the priority at CMS will, quote, always be the safety, well-being, and education of every student. And Julian, you also spoke to Julian Parmenter about this.
Our responsibility as educators is to provide a safe and nurturing environment for students and to consider the whole child's needs, not just their academic needs.
So in that CMS statement, Julian, they said that they would continue to comply with federal statutes, state statutes, and board policy. But did they address what would happen if ICE or other law enforcement entered a school and attempted to remove a student or a member of the staff?
A lot of people, teachers and immigrant advocates that I've been speaking to, they say no. They do say that if ICE does come to a school, they need to have a judge signed warrant. And if they do have a judge signed warrant, then the ICE agent can go into the school and conduct searches, or if they need to arrest a student, they can do that. However, teachers have been telling me that they feel like there needs to be more information given to them. They feel like they need to have trainings on how to prepare if ICE does show up.
Mary, schools and churches, as I understand it, at least the last I heard, maybe things have changed because things are changing rapidly. But schools and churches are no longer off limits for these kind of activities by law enforcement in this new administration. Has any school been the subject of a search or removal of any student or staff member anywhere in the country so far?
I'm not exactly sure. There were reports coming out of Chicago, then folks said, well, no, they haven't been in a school. So I do think that the goal of this is to create confusion and fear around it, because actually some of these executive orders are countering or they're the opposite of what has been not just policy, but in schools, you are not, in American schools, you're supposed to educate every student, no matter their status. And also you're not allowed to ask them their status. I think there's a fear that they will come and hover around the school and actually target the parent. So actually a lot of things that the schools are doing, they have always been doing, and they should continue to do them. But a lot of these orders seem to contradict it. But I do think the goal is to create this sort of confusion and fear. There will be lawsuits, but of course lawsuits take a while to work their way through the courts. So I know in the public schools CMS, teachers are encouraged not to give any sort of legal advice because obviously it's not binding, it may be false, and they don't want to give folks sort of a false sense of comfort that they're okay with it. But they have been hamstrung. I know Julian has reported this because they want to give them as much information as they can.
Eric.
To Mary's point, I just thought it was interesting that the statement from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board specifically cited the 1982 Supreme Court case saying just what Mary said, which is that everyone is entitled to a free public education, documented, undocumented, everyone.
So confusion is the order of the day, and that seems to be the if there's one thing that the Trump administration is successful at, 1.0 or 2.0, it is confusion and creating it. And Julian, you report that the situation out of Washington, along with CMS's statement, has resulted in confusion among some staff and teachers. And you say that CMS has told teachers and staff not to give legal advice, as Mary just said, to students or to parents. One teacher who asked to remain anonymous offered this.
When we give them this information, it's not like they're under the impression that I am giving them legal advice or that I am acting as their attorney of law.
And she added that there are a lot of gray areas, so teachers don't feel they have a clear instruction on how to protect students. You say, Julian, that in some school districts around the country, campaigns have started to hand out information about basic rights. Under the United States Constitution, the pamphlets are called Know Your Rights. Will that fly under CMS policy?
As of now, no. And it doesn't seem like there is going to be an immediate change to that policy. People that I've spoken to on the CMS board, as well as in the CMS school system, are saying that these Know Your Rights materials are considered legal advice. So unless there is a discrepancy on the cards, on the materials that say CMS is not responsible for these materials, then there is no possible way that they should be given out.
But are they sending out mixed signals? I mean, when CMS, the district, on the one hand says they will always protect their students, but on the other says they will comply with federal guidelines, how do you navigate that? They're in opposition to each other.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hearing from teachers and immigrant advocates. They say if they aren't able to give out this information, who else is going to give students and parents this legal information?
Mary.
And I think you're probably going to have a test at some point where somebody might come to a school without that judge-signed warrant, and you would have to refuse them based on that. And then what would happen? And I also really want to emphasize that a teacher's mission is to teach students, as the teacher that Julian interviewed said. So all of this is getting in the way of that. You know, my son is a professor. You're burdened anyway with all the things you have to do in a school to accommodate each of the children in your classroom, to now think you have to also feel that there might be an ICE agent at the door is something that's really going to make the teaching less effective for all the students.
Joe Bruno.
Here's a scenario that I'm not sure, I hope CMS is prepared for, has an idea how they would handle it. What if the man I saw get arrested yesterday ditched his car at a school and ran inside the building? Then how would the school handle that? I'm not sure the policy lays out that scenario in a clear way on how the district would go about that.
Aren't the doors to schools supposed to be locked?
They're supposed to be, yes.
I'm just asking. Meanwhile, a funding freeze went into effect this week. It's been in all the papers. With federal employees being locked out of the building, losing access to their computers and to their emails, Julian, I only have a minute left here in the segment, but you report the impact of that is already being felt in Charlotte. How so?
Yeah, so there's refugee programs here in Charlotte that are meant to help refugees settle here in the area. They furloughed a majority of their employees, specifically Church World Service Charlotte. The majority of its 20 employees were furloughed, 60 days, no pay. Many of them are looking for new jobs. So this federal funding freeze is having a large impact locally.
So we still have some more to talk about with regard to what's happening with immigration, both in the community at large and with other sub-communities in that general community of immigrants. And then we'll talk about Brooklyn Village and the redevelopment plans shifting a bit as a result of a meeting with County Commission this week. It's a plan that has been long in the making, and they're trying to expedite it somehow with these changes. We'll see if that works when we come back in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Zach Turner, our climate reporter at WFAE News. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary C. Curtis is the host of the Roll of the Equal Time podcast and a columnist at rollcall.com. And Julian Berger is with us in this first part of the program. He's WFAE's race and equity reporter who's been covering what's going on with the immigrant community in this new administration. And we wanted to talk to him about some of those things that have been happening here this week. Mary Ramsey, reporting in the Charlotte Observer, says that billionaire Elon Musk, who has been handed the keys to the kingdom and who is making wholesale alterations to aspects of the federal government as head of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, the artful Dozier. We know what the artful Dodger did. Anyway, despite being unelected, not being an official government employee, possessing no legal standing to do anything that he's doing, has targeted Lutheran Services Carolinas. They provide senior living, child care, mental health care, and immigrant services throughout both North and South Carolina. Julian, what is he doing?
Yeah, so he targeted Lutheran Services Carolinas, or Lutheran Services nationally, on social media this week. And basically that resulted in their services kind of being halted by the federal government. So the funding that they do receive, they're not receiving it anymore. So Lutheran Services Carolinas is saying that their organization that resettles legal refugees here in the Charlotte area is halted. They can't really work on that anymore. And that they say it will make it significantly harder for refugee families in Charlotte.
I think this is interesting because former Trump National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, who was sentenced to 6 months in prison for making false statements to the FBI and who was then pardoned by Donald Trump, made a social media post saying the use of, quote, religion as a money laundering operation must end, and listing Lutheran Family Services of the Carolinas as one of the operations to which he was referring. Elon Musk then shared that post. Is that why DOGE is going after them? Because Mike Flynn, the liar, made a post about this?
Yeah, it seems like that's the case. And like I mentioned in the first segment, they're not the only refugee program to be under threat now. There's been so many other refugee programs within the country that have been fearing that their federal funding would be cut. And like I said before, Church World Service as well got their funding cut by the federal government.
Mary?
Yeah, I want to emphasize, as Julian said, these are all legal refugees. So we're not talking about people who are undocumented or here illegally. Also, I think there's a contradiction within the Trump administration and its officials because they complain about anti-Christian bias. He's even writing up more orders. He's going to attack anti-Christian bias. But this is a Christian organization. So it's very clear that you have to be his kind of Christian, doing his kind of work. The white evangelicals and the Christian nationalists who support him are fine. And not only that, but they need to be protected. But other Christian groups that are doing work that you might see, I don't know, in the Bible, to helping folks resettle and welcoming the stranger, they are involved in a, quote, money laundering operation. So again, here is another contradiction.
Well, Christian nationalists are neither Christian nor patriots, and fears in the local community about moves being made by Donald Trump extend out from the immigrant community to other areas, including the LGBTQ community. Is this coming from Trump's orders concerning trans individuals? Is that what is engendering this fear, Julian?
Yeah, so the Trump administration and Trump 1.0, we saw this, now Trump 2.0. The Trump administration is issuing a lot of executive orders targeting specifically trans people. He also put in an executive order that defines only two biological sexes. So there's been a lot of fear within the LGBTQ community, and I've been speaking to a lot of LGBTQ people here in Charlotte about this.
In his first term, Trump opposed the Equality Act, which guaranteed non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people and banned transgender people from serving in the military. His return to office has spiked fears, as we've been talking about. And here's what 23-year-old Chandler Muhammad told you, Julian.
It hasn't even been a month yet, and he's doing so much. We're such a small part of the population. Targeting us when there's all of these issues happening, it doesn't make logical sense to target us right now.
Or ever. Chandler is trans, non-binary, but Trump recently signed an executive order recognizing the existence of only two genders, called for transgender women to be moved to men's prisons, and pushed again to ban them from the military. Aside from those restrictions, to be applied nationwide, has anything happened that is exclusively local, Julian?
Nothing that's been exclusively local. It's mainly these executive orders from the Trump administration that have come down recently. And Chandler, like you said, is a non-binary person. They've been seeking therapy at Time Out Youth since these executive orders have come into place.
Julian Berger covers race and equity for us here at WFAE News. Julian, thank you for joining us. We will continue to focus on this program, on the local impact of the Trump administration in the coming weeks. Thanks a lot. The Brooklyn Village Redevelopment Project in Second Ward Uptown has been in the works for a very long time. And on Tuesday, Mecklenburg County commissioners appeared supportive of a plan to redo the first phase of that project. Joe, what changes are they contemplating?
So the original plan from like 10 years ago called for two apartment buildings with about 50 or so affordable housing units. It might have been one apartment building, but the point stands, it was about 50 affordable housing units of the 500 or so proposed units. Now the plan is for two just affordable housing apartment complexes to be part of the first phase of the development at the old Bob Walton Plaza site. So 250 units going
so
from
when
50
you take,
to 50.
Okay, so when you take, you reduce the number of, if you completely eliminate the at market rate apartments and you make everything affordable housing, that's got to affect the bottom line. Why are they offering this up?
And Eric, feel free to jump in here. My gut is tax credits easier for them to build to affordable housing complexes, believe it or not, than it would be to build this market rate with a portion of affordable housing.
Yeah, that's exactly at least my interpretation of what they're doing. And part of that, of course, is Joe mentioned this has been going on since the first Obama administration. It feels like it's 9 years, and the county has been antsy. There were meetings this, I guess, in the last year where commissioners really got frustrated and said, hey, why is nothing happening? And so the developers got with county staff and tried to figure out a way to speed this up. To Joe's point, this kind of financing will probably allow them to speed it up. It also hits on affordable housing, which we talk about all the time on this show and across Charlotte. And what's interesting is, as Joe said, you're cutting the number of apartments in half, but they're all affordable housing. And whereas in the first batch, you would have had 50 units that were roughly for people that are making $44,000 and below, now you're going to go from $22,000 to about $60,000. So you're hitting a much wider population, and you're hitting that lowest income, which is the hardest affordable housing to build.
One of those commissioners who was concerned about the delay was Elaine Powell. This project was first approved 9 years ago in 2016, and nothing has been built yet. Why has there been such a delay on this project?
That's a great question. And there have been all kinds of reasons offered, market conditions, the plans change. There have been all kinds of things said, but the bottom line is what you started with, Mike, that it's been 9 years, nothing's happened. Now, with what we heard this week, the hope is that groundbreaking will occur either at the end of this year or at the beginning of 2026. And then I think another year or so after that, they would open. So we'll see. And remember, as Joe pointed out, this is only the first phase. I think this is about 5.7 acres out of 17 acres that are ultimately planned for development. So we'll see if this can get off the ground. And if it does, what happens with the rest of these projects?
So former commission chair, now commissioner, George Dunlap, had this to say in response to Elaine Powell's concerns over this long 9-year delay.
But the reason they're here tonight is because some were so concerned about the delay, they wanted to see something go up and ask for a change.
So is he saying that People's Construction, those are the people developing this, that the whole reason for them being there was a preemptive attempt to address these concerns? What is he saying there?
If you think back to a couple months ago, commissioners, it was during the election season, were openly asking the city attorney, county attorney, to find a way out of the contract. Like, it's been 9 years, nothing's happened, doesn't seem like anything's going to happen for another couple of years. Can we get out of this? And the county attorney, from what I understand, basically said, no, you guys are trapped. And I do think that a developer does want to build something. He doesn't want to just pay taxes, hundreds of thousands of taxes on this land with nothing coming up. And this is a sign of a project the developer thinks can be built faster. And, you know, depending on who you ask, you might think it's better than what was originally proposed. Two affordable housing units, allowing people who make the lowest amount of money in Mecklenburg County to live in Uptown. There's going to be retail there. There's going to be some good portions if this ever gets built. And the developer has to prove that that's going to happen.
Eric.
Just real quickly, Mike, I said a year to build, 18 to 20 months is actually how long it will take to build. And the other thing I want to mention is, to Joe's point, the developer did pay $10 million in July of 2023 for this piece of property. So they do have some motivation to do something with it.
And this is for people who may be new to town. This is Second Ward, which is bounded by McDowell, Trade, Martin Luther King, and I think Tryon.
Brooklyn Village
Street. Yeah, yes. Brooklyn Village. Yeah.
Yes.
Mary.
Yeah. And I just bring a little historical perspective to it. And you set that up beautifully, Mike, why it's being called Brooklyn. This goes back to the time of urban renewal, some would say removal, when a vibrant Black neighborhood was raised and people and the folks went scattered around. It was thought to be done very badly. And so whatever replaces this at this point, that's what was called Brooklyn. That's why they want to make sure that folks of all incomes will be able to enjoy this part, or else it would be kind of, you know, we're replacing it with another high end, very expensive Charlotte apartment complex. But no, we want to have this be free for everyone to enjoy Uptown, to enjoy the retail. And so that's a piece of it. So folks who, you know, just came to Charlotte, you wouldn't even know. I mean, even when I came here, you couldn't tell that this had been this vibrant neighborhood.
So you mean there's retail uptown? So what happens what happens next, Eric, to this project?
Well, next, this was informational. The commissioners will take a vote to allow the county manager to amend the plans. And then, assuming all those things happen, you will have a groundbreaking near the end of this year, and they will pick it up and open some affordable housing in probably late 2027, if everything goes according to plan.
Joe.
And there's an ask, too, for some gap financing, $2.5 million the county will have to provide.
Yes, so it's a $100 million project.
WFAE's Climate Reporter Zach Turner has been in the bullpen warming up. He's on deck now after long last. This week, Charlotte's Office of Sustainability and Resilience updated its strategic energy plan and presented it to City Council Committee. What did they propose, Zach?
Yeah, I'm fully charged now, Mike. So every 5 years, Charlotte is updating their strategic energy action plan. They accepted, City Council accepted or passed this plan back in December 2018. So it's about that time. And then they updated a few goals, and they also delayed a couple of their goals that they had set previously. So originally, the city wanted to reduce per capita community-wide emissions to 2 tons of CO2 by 2050. They also wanted to source 100% of energy for buildings and the city fleet from carbon-free sources. And so they amended a little bit of that language, like kind of parsed some stuff out and like separated a couple of things. So now Charlotte is looking to reduce or offset all community-wide greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. It's a little bit more of a complete goal there. This also includes all citywide emission sources such as food waste and transportation. The city also amended some language regarding how it's going to go about transitioning some of its buildings, saying that it's going to source 100% of its electricity and municipal buildings from carbon-free sources. But they also want to keep the flexibility here to use backup generators that use natural gas or fossil fuels in the case of emergency. They're also looking at transitioning now their fleet. Instead of doing all of their fleet by 2030, they're pushing it back to 2035 and focusing on light duty vehicles like small trucks, cars, and street sweepers.
So they're delaying some of, or they're lowering their expectations on some things, but they're also adding new goals, which Sarah Hazel, who is Charlotte's sustainability officer, described as aspirational.
They're aspirational because they're so ambitious, and some pieces of them are things that either are outside the city's control or require really a whole of society approach.
So which of the goals are aspirational?
All of them. All of them all are. I think they would describe all of the goals as aspirational.
And, are they more so than the previous goals? Are they more so than what came before?
Well, this is, when I was talking with Sarah Hazel, this was kind of a point that she wanted to make clear, is that they've always been aspirational goals. These are goals that they're setting their sights on. It's kind of like their North Star. If you're sailing a ship, you've got this star in the sky and you're heading towards it, and you might never reach that star specifically, but as long as you're heading in that direction, you're going to make some positive change. And that was one of the questions I had for her, is like, how should people think of this? Is this something they should be holding the city to? And I think part of the issue here, and this is something that council member Ed Driggs brought up when he was listening to this presentation that the Charlotte Office of Sustainability was giving, is that so much of what happens to Charlotte's climate is not necessarily determined by what happens in Charlotte. It also has bearings on what's done at the state and federal level. And right now, Charlotte's got to navigate a state and federal governments that are not necessarily aligned on climate spending.
Right. Or friendly about climate change initiatives. As Hazel indicated to you, the community, us, have to buy into these green efforts if we are to meet these goals. And under the current administration, which has no appetite for anything environmental and is stripping away incentives to achieve things that might help the environment, are we just spitting into the wind here?
Not necessarily. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of things that the city can do. There's the option for the city to be a little bit more, I guess, put a little bit more at stake here, incentivize even private investors to make different decisions, similar to how we do with affordable housing. Charlotte is, you know, gives these incentives to builders so that they'll build in a particular type of way or in a particular type of place. They could also do something similar for more sustainable development. And then people also have a choice in terms of how they decide to commute or if they decide to adopt certain technologies. So it's a little bit of the city, a little bit of the people.
When we come back, the Riggs-Griffin case continues to slog its way through the courts. We'll talk about that. It's in a new court this morning at 10. And Governor Stein has asked the legislature for $1 billion in Hurricane Helene relief funds. We'll get to that in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Zach Turner is here. He's our climate reporter for WFAE News. Joe Bruno's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Mary C. Curtis is columnist at RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. The Allison Riggs-Jefferson-Griffin race continues. The whole race is about who's going to determine who's going to get the seat on the state Supreme Court. There's one open seat. It's currently held by Allison Riggs, the Democratic incumbent, and then it's being contested by the Republican challenger, Jefferson Griffin. And last week, the case was heard by the Fourth Circuit Court, a federal court, not on its merits, but on whether the federal or state courts have jurisdiction. That three-judge panel unanimously kicked it back to state court, but added the federal court will have jurisdiction over any federal issues raised by the State Board of Elections. What does all this mean, Joe?
Means we're never getting a state Supreme Court justice. I mean, it's like, oh my gosh. I mean, we had all, 3 months now of just deciding which court should hear the arguments. And now today, finally, we will hear the arguments. It'll start in Wake County Superior Court. The judge that's hearing this case already ruled against a similar protest that was brought that has similar complaints to what Jefferson Griffin is alleging now But this is just going to get appealed and then appealed again through the state Supreme Court. And we have to see what they decide. So we're looking at probably another couple of months still, as awful as that is to say, before we have clarity in this race.
So to be clear, after several bipartisan recounts, the incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs is ahead by 734 votes. The current head of the Supreme Court in North Carolina won his seat by less than that several years ago. Jefferson Griffin, the Republican challenger, and other GOP forces are challenging over 60,000 votes. They honed in on 5,000 votes from mostly Democratic candidates, counties rather, or voting areas. And now he's focused in on 500 votes he says were cast by people who have never lived in North Carolina, who have never lived in the United States, but they are legally allowed to vote in these elections because of a law that's been in, on the books for forever. So is that what they will be considering at the Wake Court this morning at 10? The validity of these
the
votes?
The merits of those 60,000 votes and whether they should count. The people who didn't show the ID who live abroad, the kids of the people who live abroad that are NC residents, and then, of course, the people who did nothing wrong. I want to reiterate that. They did nothing wrong. They provided their Social Security number on their registration forms, many of them, and for some reason this database did not reflect that, and now their vote is being challenged.
And just for this race?
Just for this race.
That's the voters
in these counties.
So if they throw, I'm going to ask this question again, and I ask it every week. If they throw out any of these 60,000 votes, these same voters voted for other people who have been sworn into office and who are holding those offices, will they be up for examination after this is over if they throw out these votes?
No, their races have been certified.
The
races have been certified in this lawsuit.
But if the races have been certified on bogus votes, they shouldn't. They should be uncertified, should they not?
Is there a
lawsuit in that?
Well, not
probably,
yet. Let's put it that way. Not yet.
Well, but also, like, there's probably a lawsuit in. Okay, if it's these five counties, let's expand to all 100 counties, and let's also try to find a way to include Election Day voters because they aren't included right now either. It's just a small portion of voters that is included in this challenge.
And Mike, it still can go into a federal court again because the election board said doing this actually affects federal laws. There's the Help America Vote Act, the National Voter Registration Act, the Voting Rights Act, and even the Civil Rights Act. So they're saying that, you know, if indeed in state court, in the state Supreme Court, it flips it, you have these federal laws that might affect this vote. And so it's not ending yet. As Joe said, it's going to go on and on because it could be back in federal court.
Eric.
And Mike, you know, like we're getting a little bit flip about this, although I think your question is serious and logical about, well, you know, what about all those other races and are they bogus? But I think what this shows is how corrosive all of this challenging can be when it goes on and on and on. I'm not saying that races should never be contested, but you begin to see how this has kind of down the rabbit hole kind of connotations.
Joe.
One thing that's underreported right now is who is funding the Griffin campaign's lawsuits and what does their money situation look like? Do they have the means to continue, bringing this up the ladder? Because, you know, NCGOP has put out some statements of support, but we're not seeing people come out of the woodworks to hold press conferences in support of Jefferson Griffin. And, you know, Allison Riggs has been fundraising off of this. She's mobilized, you know, really the Democratic Party across the country. It's easy for Riggs to raise money to oppose it. I'm not seeing unless it's all dark money, I'm not seeing a vocal public support of what Griffin is doing.
Okay, so speaking of money, this week Governor Josh Stein asked lawmakers for more than $1 billion in relief funding for Hurricane Helene recovery. That's almost double the total amount allocated by the state so far.
Our objective with these funds are to address immediate needs, to use existing programs, because if you're using an existing program rather than creating a new one, you can get the money out the door quickly. And we want to help folks right now. We don't want to wait till the budget is finalized in July or August, because for many small businesses, that will be too late.
The leaders of both the House and the Senate, both Republicans, have promised to make Helene relief a top priority. Why has their response been so slow, Joe?
Partly, I believe, because the legislature just, this is the first full week of the legislature, and they were only in session for a couple of days. They just got sworn in. But we're starting to see it pick up a little bit. Governor Stein asked for a little more than $1 billion. They're debating about $500 million right now, but many of the things in that bill are what Governor Stein wanted, just in different quantities of dollars. But I think that's just, this is just a start, and we can expect more Helene relief bills throughout the spring.
And to be fair, the state has already allocated $901 million, that's almost $1 billion, through three recovery packages, and appropriated an additional $227 million. So that's over $1 billion for relief, but they haven't assigned it yet to be spent. And Governor Stein says small business owners can already begin applying for assistance through existing programs, but his hope is to expand those programs.
If you're a small business owner, you suffered losses, your revenues are less than $2.5 million, go on the website at Appalachian Community Capital and apply. That window will be open for 1 month. It will then take a couple few weeks to review those applications. Our hope is that by the end of March, those funds are out the door.
This request of the General Assembly comes at a time when state officials have been warning that federal aid, particularly for housing, could be delayed for months and possibly into the fall. Still, Stein says he's encouraged by Donald Trump's recent visit to Western North Carolina.
He reiterated to me personally, but also to the public, that he will not forget Western North Carolina. His administration won't forget Western North Carolina. I've subsequently spoken to the National Security Advisor twice and the acting head of FEMA. They are very focused on this.
And Stein hopes Congress approves another disaster relief bill in March. Meanwhile, the legislature has yet to begin debate, have they not? Is that true on the budget that will also include some funds here?
A committee met and debated a Helene relief bill, but not the full legislature.
Eric?
Just real quickly, as we're talking about $900 million and $1 billion, remember, damages, $53 billion. Right. So there is so much need.
After several weeks of executive orders from the White House that, if unchallenged, will fundamentally change how our government operates and the very nature of the kind of government that we have, protests are starting to break out in various cities across the country. On Wednesday, thousands of protesters marched around the state capitol in Raleigh. Mary, what were they protesting about?
Well, they were protesting, well, first of all, Trump's executive orders, and also the influence, oversized influence, of the unelected Elon Musk, whose bro crew have gone in and they have access to employee records, financial records, treasury records. We see one 25-year-old member of this crew have to resign because it has surfaced that he had incredibly racist and horrible texts and emails and tweets and things like that. And that's what they were protesting, because it's going to affect them, people who get any kind of money from the government, people who are employed by the government. They are closing departments. So we see them protesting now. I'm not sure what it's going to do, but I think when you see at least a thousand people show up, it's starting to sink in, this flurry. Donald Trump is flooding the zone with these flurry of executive orders, so it's really difficult to keep up with them. Veterans are wondering what's going to happen with their benefits. They're part of the folks who are part of the anti-DEI campaign, people who are disabled. So they were protesting pretty much everything, but a lot on the influence of Elon Musk and his crew.
It's interesting. Unlike many recent protests in the last 5 years where the protest signs look professionally produced, as you look at these protests around the country, they're all handwritten on poster board like they were in the 60s. And in this case, they were reading things like, "No felon, no Elon, stand up against Trump or step down, stop the monarchy, egg prices down yet? Stop the coup and stop the steal. How many people marched in Raleigh? Do we know?
I think they said it started out with hundreds and it got up to at least a little over 1,000, I believe.
So was the protest at the state capitol at the state capitol because it's closer than Washington, or because they hope that state legislators will get involved in this and relay their concerns to D.C.?
I think both, because it seems like Republicans, legislators at least, are falling in line with everything. Even some who had in the past, like our senator, Tom Tillis, had expressed certain reservations about both the policies and the people he's populating the government with. He talks about merit, but I think, you know, when you just say Pete Hegseth, say, and you see that it's not about merit, it's pretty much about loyalty to Donald Trump.
Immediately following the election, pundits pointed to Trump winning because of pushback to wokeism, but mainly because for all of the strengths of the American economy, life was getting tougher for ordinary Americans. The price of eggs in particular and groceries in general were important to voters, and Trump promised to fix all of that on day one. It is now day 18, and I was at the grocery store yesterday. I don't believe anything has been done about the price of groceries yet, but he has been throwing a lot on the wall, including taking over Greenland and the Panama Canal and making Canada the 51st state. I wrote a paper about that in fifth grade, by the way. And now owning the that was the mentality that I had in the fifth grade. And now owning the Gaza Strip. Politically, is this eventually going to hurt him, Mary?
Well, we will see if it, by the way, when you're at the grocery store, did you put a down payment on a dozen eggs? but we'll see. You know, the folks who are for Trump feel that he's playing this long game. But I think when it starts to hit, it's already a majority of white women voted for Trump for the third time. And I think they're already saying, when you said anti-DEI, I thought you didn't mean me. And so many of people who voted for him, Latino men, when you were talking about deporting criminals, I thought you didn't mean anybody in my family. So I think it's almost as though people have to have it hit at home, and it's starting to hit at home. We will see for sure how much it is affecting his popularity. We already see, you know, he wasn't elected by a majority of the people in America. We'll see it in the midterm, certainly in 2026. Particularly if he makes some of these foreign incursions and things like that, that are so contradictory to what he campaigned on.
We keep hearing about the mandate. He won by 1.8% over Kamala Harris, and more people did not vote at all than voted for either of the two candidates. So let's talk about the price of eggs, Joe. They're going up nationwide. How is that impacting grocery shoppers and restaurants here?
Well, it seems like, you know, the price, first of all, it depends what kind of eggs you get. I get the regular eggs, just the one at the bottom of the shelf. But,
now,
people buy pasture eggs. People buy, you know, free range, you know, chickens lived at the Ballantine Resort eggs. Like, you know, there's all sorts of eggs out there. Generally, a 12 pack of eggs right now is between $6 and $9, which is probably what people were paying for a 30 pack of eggs a couple of months ago.
And you spoke to Matt King, who's the owner of Maddie's Diner on the Plaza. This was his reaction to rising egg prices.
I think my first response was not how they're impacting me, but how they're killing me.
And although he's paying a higher price, so are his customers.
Literally have new menu coming out in 2 days because of what we're talking about. So we've had to raise the price of adding an egg to $2.
What? $2? I've heard 50 cents. Now it's $2? Is that happening everywhere?
Pretty much. You know, what Waffle House is doing is they're tacking on 50 cents per egg to each bill. So if you order a 3-egg omelet, your price just went up $1.50. But what Waffle House isn't doing is just raising prices across the menu in a blanket style. So your waffle isn't impacted, just your omelet is. But yeah, restaurants in general, especially the ones that serve brunch, you're going to start to see $1, $2 more for your egg-based dishes.
If you make an omelet, you're going to break a few wallets. That's the way it goes.
Sorry.
Very quickly, former Carolina Panthers and Commanders head coach Ron Rivera has decided that if Bill Belichick can go back to college, So can he. In fact, he tweeted, Belichick has made going back to school cool. He's going back to the University of California, but he will not be the head coach there. Quickly, what will he be doing there, Eric?
He'll be overseeing everything, coaches, players, budgets, and yes, he is ready to go back. And
is this migration good for college or NFL football?
I'm not sure, but it's good for Ron, so good for Riverboat Ron as Charlotte's walk star.
Eric Spanberg, Mary C. Curtis, Joe Bruno, Zach Turner, thank you all for the hour. We're plumb out of time.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.